in such a voice, as if he had paused to take a quick, half-guilty glance in the mirror. Here is one such glance from his journal of September 12, 1876, which was, coincidentally, the very day that dignitaries in evening dress filed up the Royal Palace's marble staircase for the opening of King Leopold II's geographical conference in Brussels. The white man in the opinion of the Waguha. How can he be a good man who comes for no trade, whose feet you never see, who always goes covered with clothes, unlike all other people? No, there is something very mysterious about him, perhaps wicked, perhaps he is a magician. At any rate, it is better to leave him alone and not disturb him. Stanley's bloody progress down the river became part of local oral history, sometimes taking on the elements of legend, for the range and accuracy of his rifle seemed supernatural to those who had never seen such weapons. A traveller some years later heard one such account. The chief of the strangers was covered with cloth, and his face was white, and it shone like sunlight on the river. The stranger chief had only one eye. It was in the middle of his forehead. When the Basoko went out on the river in their war canoes to fight and capture the strangers, they cried, "Meat! Meat!" for they intended eating their bodies. But they were not to be captured, and they killed many of the Basoko with sticks, which sent forth thunder and lightning. They spoke words in a strange tongue. They drifted on down the river and passed the strong Basoko with jeers. This Basoko image of Stanley as one-eyed could be a memory, filtered through many retellings, of seeing him squinting through a telescope or a rifle sights. It also strangely echoes the image of the one-eyed creatures some medieval European geographers imagined Africans to be. We know from a later scrap of oral tradition that Europeans were often believed to have hoofs. Not having seen shoes before, some Africans along the river thought them part of white anatomy. Several hundred miles downstream from his starting point, Stanley had to portage around rapids, which he named Stanley Falls. After that, there were no more natural obstacles to his progress for 1,000 miles to Stanley Pool. It was clear sailing for the Lady Alice and the fleet of about 2 dozen canoes the expedition had bought or stolen from people living along the river bank. Stanley and his Zanzibari porters and soldiers watched in awe as the river grew in size, becoming at times so wide they could barely see across it. Its expanse was sprinkled with some 4,000 islands, many of them inhabited. In the languages spoken along its banks, it was known not as the Congo, but, because of its many tributaries, as the Nzadi, or Nzeri, meaning the river that swallows all rivers. Stanley did not venture up these side rivers, but as he passed one after another, each hundreds of yards across, he was impressed by their size. As well he might have been. Just one of the Congo's tributaries, the Kasai, carries as much water as the Volga, and is half again as long as the Rhine. Another, the Ubangi, is even longer. Steamboats on this network, Stanley immediately saw, could travel long distances. It was as if he had found the equivalent of thousands of miles of railroad track already laid. The power possessing the Congo, he wrote, would absorb to itself the trade of the whole of the enormous basin behind. This river is and will be the grand highway of commerce to West-Central Africa. The last leg of Stanley's extraordinary journey proved by far the hardest. At the head of the 220-mile final stretch of rapids, where the river bulged out to make Stanley Pool, the explorer's easy floating came to an end. He was prepared to portage around rapids and waterfalls, but what he did not realize was how much of the river's rush to the sea was through rock gorges that compressed the water into fast-moving, unnavigable shoots of white foam. He grew steadily more dismayed. In many places, the current, he estimated by timing tree trunks that floated past, was 30 miles an hour. Take a strip of sea blown over by a hurricane, and a pretty accurate conception of its leaping waves may be obtained. There was first a rush down into the bottom of an immense trough, and then, by its sheer force, the enormous volume would lift itself upward steeply until, gathering itself into a ridge, it suddenly hurled itself 20 or 30 feet straight upward before rolling down into another trough. The base of either bank, consisting of a long line of piled boulders of massive size, was buried in the tempestuous surf. The roar was tremendous and deafening. I can only compare it to the thunder of an express train through a rock tunnel. Hoping, usually in vain, for calm stretches of river between such rapids, the explorer ignored the advice of local Africans, and for an almost fatally long time did not abandon the Lady Alice and his dugout canoes. It was particularly agonizing to move the canoes overland, for they could not be taken apart and carried like the Lady Alice. The largest canoe was 54 feet long and weighed 3 tons. The men had to cut and pile brush along a rough path, then drag the canoes forward. Sometimes they built tracks of logs and used other logs crosswise as rollers. It took 37 days to go one stretch of 34 miles. Again and again the jagged crystal mountains threw up barriers. At one point the weary and emaciated men had to pull the boats up 1,200 feet, then along 3 miles of relatively level ground, then down again. The rainy season arrived, with downpours that lasted 5 or 6 hours a day. The perpetual noise of the rapids grew ever more oppressive. Men fainted from hunger. Stanley's last pair of boots disintegrated. One of his best men lost his mind and raced off into the bush, carrying only a parrot. Finally, after wasting months dragging the now useless boats, the expedition abandoned them entirely. In Stanley's diary, as he despairingly records one death, mass desertion, or mutiny after another, his elegant handwriting becomes almost illegible and his prose incoherent. Altogether, it took him and his starving, disease-ridden band 4.5 months to travel overland the 250 miles from Stanley Pool to the seaport of Boma. The explorer was vague and contradictory in his numbers, but the death toll among the expedition's members was overwhelming. Many succumbed to festering wounds, dysentery, smallpox, or typhus, all exacerbated by spells of near starvation. Stanley would not allow porters ill with smallpox to stay behind and convalesce, or even to walk off into the forest to die. He made them carry their loads until they dropped. And he drove himself almost as hard as he did his men. On the journey he lost more than 60 pounds. Several times the expedition ran perilously short of water. It endured snake and hippo attacks, speargrass, worms that bored into the soles of porters' feet, and paths that led over knife-sharp rocks. By the time the survivors reached Boma, they were numb with exhaustion, suffering from what today we would call post-traumatic stress syndrome. Several soon died of no apparent cause, waiting to sail home. "What means have I to convey my heart's load of love to you?" Stanley had written Alice Pike from the middle of the continent. "But this letter, which must go through 1,000 miles of savages, exposed to all dangers of flood and fire and battle until it reaches the sea. Grant then that my love towards you is unchanged, that you are in my dream, my stay and my hope and my beacon, and believe that I shall cherish you in this light until I meet you." When he brought his remaining porters and soldiers by sea back to their jumping-off point in Zanzibar, Stanley had a shock. Amid 2 years' worth of mail waiting for him was a newspaper clipping, 18 months old, announcing that Alice Pike had married an Ohio railway heir named Albert Barney. Stanley fell into a deep depression and never saw her again. In public statements after his trip, Stanley made the usual condemnations of the Arab slave trade, called for missionaries to come to Africa, fulminated about the way Africans went about in the general indecency of their nakedness, and proclaimed that the aim of his journey was to flash a torch of light across the western half of the dark continent. In public statements after his trip, Stanley made the usual condemnation of the Arab slave trade, called for missionaries to come to Africa, fulminated about the way Africans went about in the general indecency of their nakedness, and proclaimed that the aim of his journey was to flash a torch of light across the western half of the dark continent. But business was never far from his mind. After leaving one district where he had been plagued by desertions and a flood, he wrote in his journal, "A farewell to it. Until some generous and opulent philanthropist shall permit me or some other to lead a force for the suppression of this stumbling block to commerce with Central Africa." The opulent philanthropist was waiting. In fact, the philanthropist was elated. For several months before Stanley emerged at Boma, Leopold had eagerly scanned the Times of London daily for news of his fate. At one point he wrote to an aide, "The first thing on the agenda seems to me to check again if Stanley has reached the Lualaba." As soon as Stanley reappeared, the king sent him a telegram of congratulations. Now Leopold could read the long Daily Telegraph articles Stanley wrote about his journey, as well as the voluminous press reports on the accolades and banquets the explorer received in Cape Town, Cairo, and his other stops on his way back to England. A joint resolution congratulating him came from both houses of the United States Congress, and fellow explorers hailed his descent of the Congo as the century's greatest feat of exploration. Leopold was now certain that this vast territory in the middle of Africa, miraculously still unclaimed by any European power, could become the colony he craved. At last, his long-dreamed-of production could reach the stage, and Stanley would be its star. The king instructed his minister in London to keep him au courant regarding news about Stanley. Behind the elegant smokescreen of his International African Association, Leopold was manoeuvring with great subtlety. "Be discreet," he told the envoy. "I'm sure if I quite openly charge Stanley with the task of taking possession, in my name, of some part of Africa, the English will stop me. If I ask their advice, they'll stop me just the same. So I think I'll just give Stanley some job of exploration, which would offend no one, and will give us the bases and headquarters which we can take over later on. Above all," Leopold told his man in London, "I do not want to risk losing a fine chance to secure for ourselves a slice of this magnificent African cake." Firing off telegrams, Leopold mapped a plan to intercept Stanley on his way home and lure him to Brussels. In Alexandria, where the explorer stopped for a few days, the king arranged for someone to plant the idea with Stanley while he was the guest of honor at a dinner on board a yacht carrying former U.S. President Ulysses S. Grant. Then, for the next step in his courtship, Leopold turned for help to an American friend in Brussels, General Henry Shelton Sanford. It was a brilliant choice. With Stanley so eagerly passing himself off as American, who better to appeal to him than a high-born countryman? General Sanford was eager to take on this glamorous mission for Leopold. Born to a wealthy Connecticut family, he had been appointed by Abraham Lincoln as American minister to Belgium, and had stayed on after his 8-year tenure ended. He and his wife, a famous beauty much younger than he, entertained lavishly at their turreted 3-story country house outside Brussels. With his stovepipe hat, gold-headed cane, pince-nez, and handsome chestnut moustache and beard, Sanford was a familiar figure in the city's highest social circles. He had never been a soldier, however. The general, as well as the sword and blue-and-gold uniform he wore for some years, were rewards for his having given a battery of cannon to an infantry regiment during the Civil War. Sanford had invested in American railroads and western real estate and in huge citrus orchards and other enterprises in Florida, giving the town that sprang up to house their workers the name of Sanford. But as with his military rank, Sanford's prowess as a financier was less than met the eye. He had the elegance of someone who had grown up with a fortune, but not the shrewdness needed to make one, and he lost money on everything he touched. He never recovered the large sums he put into a series of odd patents, for a wool loom, a new type of whiskey still, and a little box designed to lubricate railroad car axles with water instead of oil. A silver mine in Nevada and a zinc mine in Arkansas proved disastrous. A Minnesota railroad went bankrupt. His cotton crop at a South Carolina plantation was devoured by caterpillars. As Sanford saw his inherited fortune draining away, his connections at the Belgian court loomed larger for him. He even named one of his sons Leopold. Always a shrewd judge of people, the king understood what royal patronage would mean to Sanford, and he flattered him ceaselessly, knowing that some day he could use him. When Sanford failed in one of many fruitless efforts to win another American diplomatic post, Leopold's aide, Baron Jules Grendel, wrote to him, "The king is pleased that you will continue to reside among us, where everyone loves and appreciates you." Like many Americans, Sanford had a fondness for royalty, and Leopold valued him, he felt, in a way that his own country did not. In January 1878, Leopold secretly dispatched Sanford and Grendel to intercept Stanley in France, where the explorer, still on his way to London, was due for another round of medals and banqueting. At the Marseille railway station, the envoys caught up with Stanley, who was thin, ill, and exhausted, and followed him to Paris, where they formally offered him a job with the International African Association. He turned down their invitation, but clearly was gratified. Always anxious about his reception in the upper reaches of society, Stanley never forgot that courtiers of the King of the Belgians, a baron and a general no less, had sought him out on his return to Europe. From France, Stanley at last headed home to London, and a hero's welcome. Despite his claiming to be American, his heart was still in England. It was the Union Jack, he said, at one banquet or white-tie dinner party after another, that ought to fly over the territory crossed by the Great River. Stanley's hopes for British interest in the Congo Basin rose when the Prince of Wales came to hear him talk. But all he said to the explorer afterward was that Stanley was wearing his medals in the wrong order. Already much of the world's map was filled with British dominions, colonies and protectorates of one sort or another. With a recession at home and their hands full with various colonial crises and rebellions overseas, few Britons seemed interested in a new territory whose main transportation route was blocked by notorious cataracts. "I do not understand Englishmen at all," Stanley wrote. "Either they suspect me of some self-interest or they do not believe me. For the relief of Livingstone, I was called an impostor. For the crossing of Africa, I was called a pirate. Nor was there enthusiasm in the United States for Congo colonization. James Gordon Bennett, Jr., in New York, now wanted to send Stanley off in search of the North Pole." Leopold continued to press his suit. He had his minister in London invite Stanley to lunch. He sent Sanford across the channel to talk to the explorer again. And he made sure that Stanley heard a few hints about his possibly making a deal with another explorer instead. Leopold knew his man. 5 months after returning to Europe, Stanley accepted an invitation to visit Belgium. Chapter 4. The treaties must grant us everything. On June 10, 1878, a steamer carried Henry Morton Stanley across the English Channel to his first meeting with the King of the Belgians. We do not know what Leopold was doing as he waited for the explorer in his office at the Royal Palace, his patient months of wooing about to bear fruit. But it would not be unreasonable to imagine that this geographer king once again looked at his maps. Such a look would have confirmed that only in Africa could Leopold hope to achieve his dream of seizing a colony, especially one immensely larger than Belgium. There was no more unclaimed territory in the Americas, and Maximilian and Carlotta's disastrous adventure in Mexico was a reminder of what could happen if one tried to take control of an independent country there. Nor were there blank spaces in Asia. The Russian Empire stretched all the way to the Pacific, the French had taken Indochina, the Dutch the East Indies, and most of the rest of southern Asia, from Aden to Singapore, was coloured with the British Empire's pink. Only Africa remained. Stanley had followed the Congo River for some 1,500 miles. He had obviously not seen all of it, though, because when he first reached it, far upstream, it was already nearly a mile wide. Full exploration would take many years, but after eagerly devouring Stanley's newspaper articles, Leopold had a rough idea of what the explorer had found. Eventually, the statistics would be known. The Congo River drains more than 1.3 million square miles, an area larger than India. It has an estimated 1/6 of the world's hydroelectric potential. Most important of all, for a 19th-century empire builder, the river and its fan-shaped web of tributaries constitute more than 7,000 miles of interconnecting waterways, a built-in transportation grid rivaled by few places on Earth. Once disassembled steamboats could be transported around the Great Rapids and onto that network, they would find wood to burn in their boilers growing right at dockside. Most of the navigable rivers ran through the fast-growing rainforest that covered half the basin. Of the people who lived in the Congo Basin, Europeans still knew little. When not drawing a bead on them through his gun sights, Stanley had been interested in them mainly as a source of supplies, people with whom he could trade trinkets or cloth for food. But he had made two important discoveries about the area's inhabitants. One was that they were no military threat. His nearly 36 battles showed their spears and arrows and decrepit muskets to be no match for his new breech-loading Snider rifles. His other discovery was that, along the crucial transportation artery of the Congo River, there was no single all-powerful state that had to be subdued. Further exploring along the river's tributaries would find several large kingdoms, but centuries of slave-hunting raids from both the East and West African coasts had severely weakened most of them. Many of the peoples of the Congo Basin were small in population. As the next round of exploration would soon show, there were more than 200 different ethnic groups speaking more than 400 languages and dialects. With the potential opposition so fragmented, conquest would be relatively easy. On the day in 1878 when he sat down for his long-anticipated meeting with Stanley, Leopold was 43. With the pedantic awkwardness of his youth far behind him, he had learned to play the royal role superbly. Although the 37-year-old Stanley was a head shorter than the king and uneasy about his rudimentary French, he too had come into his own. The ne'er-do-well naval deserter of a mere 13 years earlier was now a best-selling author, recognized as one of the greatest of living explorers. His stern, mustachioed face appeared in magazines everywhere beneath a Stanley cap, his own invention. It had a high crown surrounded by ventilation holes, a brim over the eyes, and a havelock, a cloth to keep the sun off ears and neck. To our eyes, the cap looks like a cross between that of a foreign legionnaire and a doorman, which in a way summed up Stanley's personality. One part titan of rugged force and mountain-moving confidence, the other a vulnerable, illegitimate son of the working class, anxiously struggling for the approval of the powerful. In photographs, each part seems visible. The explorer's eyes carry both a fierce determination and a woundedness. At this first meeting, Leopold immediately put Stanley at ease in fluent English. The men who met each other that June day at the Royal Palace each represented a class type that would become familiar. The commanders of the ground troops in the great African land grab, the whites who led soldiers into the bush, directed the rifle and machine gun fire and wielded the surveyor's instruments, who braved malaria, dysentery and typhoid, were often, like Stanley, from the lower or lower middle class in their home countries. For them, Africa was a chance to gain upward mobility toward wealth and glory. But those who made the greatest fortunes from the scramble for Africa, like Leopold, were often men who had fortunes to begin with. Although he had lived a pampered life in yachts and palaces, Leopold was, of the two, the wiser in the ways of the world. He had taken the measure of Stanley's ambition, of his immense capacity for hard work, of his craving for constant flattery, and of his need for a sponsor. Stanley, still smarting from British lack of interest in the Congo, was delighted to meet a monarch who admired what he had done and wanted him to do more. After that meeting, Stanley travelled about Europe for the rest of 1878, promoting Through the Dark Continent, meeting members of the new Stanley Club in Paris, and receiving honours everywhere. Leopold sent messages and emissaries after him to keep his man on the hook. Before the year was out, the two had agreed on the terms of Stanley's return to the Congo, this time working for the king. Stanley's contract ran for 5 years. He would be paid 25,000 francs a year for time spent in Europe, and 50,000 francs, roughly 250,000 in today's dollars, a year for time spent in Africa. And, of course, Leopold would fund the expeditionary force to accompany him. They agreed that Stanley would first set up a base near the river's mouth, and then construct a road around the rapids, through the rugged Crystal Mountains, a precursor to a railroad. Over this road, porters would carry several steamboats, broken down into small pieces, which Stanley would later assemble and use to travel upstream, building a chain of trading stations along the 1,000-mile navigable main stretch of the Congo River. Afterward, he could write a book about his experiences, but Leopold would have the right to edit it. Of the riches Leopold hoped to find in the Congo, the one that gleamed most brightly in his imagination was ivory. European and American merchants were already eagerly buying African ivory in the markets of Zanzibar. Because it could be easily carved, ivory in the 19th century was a more rare and expensive version of what plastic is today, with the added cachet of having an exotic origin, a cachet that grew greater with the public idolization of African explorers. Ivory from elephant tusks was shaped into knife handles, billiard balls, combs, fans, napkin rings, piano and organ keys, chess pieces, crucifixes, snuff boxes, brooches and statuettes. In a faint echo of its original use to the elephant, it was made into false teeth. Despite the long distances ivory had to be carried from the elephant ranges far inland, it was attractive to dealers all the way along the line because, like drugs or precious metals, it had high value and low bulk. The 100 pounds of ivory in an average pair of African elephant tusks could make hundreds of piano keys or thousands of false teeth. Ivory dealers preferred African elephant tusks to Indian, and the elephants of equatorial Africa, which included the Congo Basin, tended to have the largest tusks of all. Stanley had found ivory so plentiful that it was used for doorposts in African homes. For the moment, such riches lay at least several years in Leopold's future, for first Stanley had to build his road. He left nothing out of the detailed budget he prepared for the king. Small boats, wooden buildings in pieces, rope, tools, African porters, and European supervisors. Among the latter were two young Englishmen who, in the tradition of Stanley's inept subordinates, had never been out of the country. Having hired neophytes, he could later rail about their inexperience. "I have had no friend on any expedition, no one who could possibly be my companion, on an equal footing, except while with Livingstone. How can he who has witnessed many wars hope to be understood by one whose most shocking sight has been a nosebleed?" Stanley was savvy enough to demand his money from Leopold in advance, because, despite a plethora of contracts, whom he was working for remained foggy. Was it the king himself, the king's International African Association, which seemed to be withering away, or a new and somewhat secretive body called the Committee for Studies of the Upper Congo? The committee's stockholders, officially, were a small group of Dutch and British businessmen and a Belgian banker, who, in fact, was quietly holding a large block of shares as Leopold's proxy. A trusted henchman of the king's, Colonel Maximilian Strauch, was the committee's president. Ambitious as his and Stanley's plans were, Leopold was intent that they be seen as nothing more than philanthropy. The contract Stanley made his European staff sign forbade them to divulge anything about the real purpose of their work. "Only scientific explorations are intended," Leopold assured a journalist. To anyone who questioned further, he could point to a clause in the committee's charter that explicitly prohibited it from pursuing political ends. The king wanted to protect himself against the widespread feeling in Belgium that, for a small country, a colony would be a money-losing extravagance. He also wanted to do nothing to alert any potential rivals for this appetizing slice of the African cake, especially France, which was starting to show interest. In February 1879, slipping on board a steamship under the name M. Henri, Stanley set off again for Africa. Behind him, in Europe, another story was unfolding. A Dutch company that had been a key shareholder in the Committee for Studies of the Upper Congo went bankrupt, its chief reportedly fleeing to New York and going to work as a horse cab driver. Leopold did not mind. He used the shock of the Dutch company's collapse to offer, in effect, a buyout of the committee's other stockholders. They gratefully accepted, and the committee legally ceased to exist before the end of the year. But as a smokescreen it was still useful, and the king continued to refer to the committee as if it were functioning, and as if its former shareholders, and not he alone, were funding Stanley and making decisions. Stanley himself did not find out about the committee's demise until more than a year after the fact. To obfuscate things still further, and give his African operations a name that could serve for a political entity, the master impresario created another new cover organization, the International Association of the Congo. This was calculated to sound confusingly similar to the moribund, philanthropic International African Association of Crown Princes and Explorers. Care must be taken not to let it be obvious that the Association of the Congo and the African Association are two different things, Leopold instructed one of his aides. The public doesn't grasp that. Adding to the public's confusion, the new International Association of the Congo, like the defunct Committee for Studies of the Upper Congo, used the flag of the International African Association, which had been adopted with much fanfare at that group's first and last meeting. A gold star on a blue background, intended to symbolize a blaze of hope in the proverbial African darkness. Even before making his deal with Stanley, Leopold had begun reaching for his slice of the African cake from the other side of the table, by financing an attempt to reach the Congo Basin from Africa's east coast. Three more such expeditions, all well publicized but inept, followed. One of them included four baggage-carrying Indian elephants with the suitably exotic names Sundergrund, Nederbuks, Sosinkali, and Pulmala. The elephants, it turned out, required 50 labourers with axes and machetes to precede them, clearing trees and branches so that they and their loads could pass through. But before dropping heavily and prematurely dead of various ailments, the elephants proved a journalist's dream. The European readers who followed each stage of the animal's unhappy journey failed to realize that the real story lay on Africa's other coast, where Stanley was quietly working on his road around the Congo River rapids. Almost imperceptibly, the name Congo now began to refer not just to a river, but to an entire territory. When the public finally did start paying attention to the new colony in the making, the king reached new heights as an illusionist. He or one of his stagehands managed to open the curtains on a completely different set each time, depending on the audience. Henry Shelton Sanford, a board member of Leopold's venture in its incarnation as the International African Association, made it sound almost like traveller's aid. In New York, on an 1879 trip to tend to his money-losing investments, Sanford gave a speech saying that the king's aim was to found a chain of posts or hospices, both hospitable and scientific, which should serve as a means of information and aid to travellers, and ultimately, by their humanizing influences, to secure the abolition of the traffic in slaves. His new International Association of the Congo, Leopold insisted in a piece he wrote and managed to get published over the byline from a Belgian correspondent in the London Times, was a sort of Society of the Red Cross. It has been formed with the noble aim of rendering lasting and disinterested services to the cause of progress. When talking to the more military-minded Germans, Leopold nimbly changed the scenery and likened his men in the Congo to the Knights of the Crusades. Almost everyone was fooled. Baroness Burdett Coutts, the British patron of missionaries, gave him a donation of 50,000 francs for his humanitarian endeavours. In the United States, one writer declared Leopold's great work enough to make an American believe in kings forever. Meanwhile, Leopold sent word that Stanley was to lay the groundwork in the Congo for a Confederation of Free Negro Republics, black tribes whose president would live in Europe and rule under the guidance of the Belgian king. This particular illusion, echoing the idea of a union of states, was likely to appeal to an American audience. To Europeans, on the other hand, the king talked about free cities. Bremen, Lübeck, Hamburg were free cities for a long time, one of his aides wrote. Why would there not be some in the Congo? Those backstage, however, knew that in either case the free was merely a prop to be removed as soon as the curtains closed. As one of Leopold's subordinates bluntly wrote to Stanley, "There is no question of granting the slightest political power to Negroes. That would be absurd. The white men, heads of the stations, retain all the powers." For 5 years, Stanley was Leopold's man in the Congo. The explorer's combative energy was now directed mainly against the territory's forbidding landscape, not its people. His crews of workmen carved a rough track, more a trail than a road, around the big rapids, using existing paths in some areas, in others cutting through brush and forest, filling in gullies, and throwing log bridges over ravines. Then they moved more than 50 tons of supplies and equipment up the trail. Draft animals like horses and oxen could not survive the Congo's climate and diseases, so supplies travelled mostly on porters' heads. After 2 years of trail-building, pulling and hauling, two small steamboats were reassembled at the top of the rapids and puffed their way up the river to land parties that set up more bases on its banks. Names left no doubt whose colony this would be. The station, established at the top of the big rapids, within earshot of their thunder and featuring a heavily fortified blockhouse and a vegetable garden, was christened Leopoldville. Above it rose Leopold Hill. Soon maps showed Lake Leopold II and the Leopold River. One of the later arriving steamboats, which would briefly be piloted by the Congo's most famous ship's officer, would be the Roi des Belges, King of the Belgians. Stanley was a harsh taskmaster. "The best punishment is that of irons," he explained in one of his letters to Brussels, "because without wounding, disfiguring, or torturing the body, it inflicts shame and discomfort." Whites were not put in irons, of course, only blacks. Illness and other dangers were even more deadly than Stanley's wrath. In the first year alone, 6 Europeans and 22 Africans under his command died, including one eaten by a crocodile. For the first time, we are at last able to see Stanley in Africa through eyes not his own. A steamboat engineer named Paul Neve fell sick and wrote home, Mr. Stanley has taken great care of me during these bad days. The sort of care a blacksmith applies to repair an implement that is most essential and that has broken down through too rough usage. Teeth clenched in anger, he smites it again and again on the anvil, wondering whether he will have to scrap it or whether he will yet be able to use it as before. Nev died several weeks later. Stanley himself might not have minded the blacksmith analogy. Every cordial-faced aborigine whom I meet, he wrote, I look upon with much of the same regard that an agriculturist views his strong-limbed child. He is a future recruit to the ranks of soldier laborers. It was during this period, when he was pushing his men so hard, that Stanley became known by the Africans who worked for him as Bulamatadi, or Bulamatari, breakstones. Stanley himself preferred the grander translation, breaker of rocks, and claimed that it was bestowed on him when he taught awed Africans how to use a sledgehammer, and when they saw giant boulders dynamited as he built the trail through the Crystal Mountains. In Stanley's account of his labours, he snorts at Africans, who are lazy by definition, and at whites, who are weak-minded. He preaches the gospel of enterprise, declaring that the European middleman who has his home in Europe but has his heart in Africa is the man who is wanted. They are the missionaries of commerce, adapted for nowhere so well as for the Congo Basin, where are so many idle hands. And nowhere does he wax as passionate as when his money-making instincts and his Victorian prudery intersect, getting the clothesless and over-tattooed Africans out of their unabashed nudity and into European clothes is his continuing obsession. I foresaw a brilliant future of Africa, if by any miracle of good fortune I could persuade the dark millions of the interior to cast off their fabrics of grass clothing and don second-hand costumes. See what a ready market lies here for old clothes. The garments shed by the military heroes of Europe, of the club lackeys, of the liveried servants of modern pharaohs, the frock coats of a lawyer, merchant, or a Rothschild, or perhaps the grave garb of these my publishers might find people of the rank of Congo chieftainship to wear them. As Stanley shuttled back and forth on foot through the rugged, humid countryside, supervising construction, he carefully kept up his personal appearance, shaving and putting blacking on his moustache each day. During this sojourn, as during all his time in Africa, his sturdy, compact frame survived the diseases that sent so many European visitors to early graves. Several times he was delirious with fever, and twice came near death. One bout of malaria, he wrote, reduced his weight to 100 pounds, and he grew too weak to speak or raise his arms. For 2 weeks he lay in his tent, convinced that the end was near, then summoned his sun-helmeted European officers and African workers to give his last instructions, to say goodbye, and to make, so he claimed, one last profession of loyalty. Tell the king that I am sorry not to have been able to carry out to a finish the mission he entrusted to me. He recovered, but some months later fell sick again, and, brought down river, was carried ashore at Leopoldville unconscious. In 1882, barely able to walk, he went back to Europe to recuperate, travelling on a slow Portuguese steamer. On this ship, he fulminated, underbred second-class passengers were allowed onto the first-class deck, where they expectorated, smoked, and sprawled in the most socialistic manner. Worse yet was an invasion by third-class females and half a score of half-naked white children. At last he was rescued from these indignities by the ship's arrival in Europe. Doctors warned Stanley that it might be fatal for him to return to the Congo, but Leopold insisted. There was still much to be done. Not only did the king want his colony secured, he also wanted the explorer out of the way for a few more years, because, always a loose cannon in public, Stanley continued to talk openly about his hopes for a British Congo. Leopold turned on the royal charm. "Surely, Mr. Stanley," he said, "you cannot think of leaving me now, just when I most need you." Simultaneously fighting a painful relapse of illness and firing off orders for an array of new equipment and supplies, Stanley returned to the Congo after only 2 months. With the great prize almost within his grasp, Leopold wanted as much land in the Congo as possible, and he wanted it now. His instructions and letters to Stanley all through these years pulsate with his lust for territory. I take advantage of a safe opportunity to send you a few lines in my bad English. It is indispensable you should purchase as much land as you will be able to obtain, and that you should place successively under suzerainty as soon as possible and without losing 1 minute all the chiefs from the mouth of the Congo to the Stanley Falls. If you let me know you are going to execute these instructions without delay, I will send you more people and more material. Perhaps Chinese coolies. Though piously assuring the British minister in Brussels that his venture in Africa had no commercial character, it did not carry on trade, Leopold had already written to Stanley, "I am desirous to see you purchase all the ivory which is to be found on the Congo, and let Colonel Strauch know the goods which he has to forward to you in order to pay for it and when. I also recommend you to establish barriers and tolls on the other parts of the road you have opened. It is but fair and in accordance with the custom of every country." Leopold and Stanley knew that other Europeans were beginning to nose around the basin. Their chief worry was the French explorer and naval officer Count Pierre Savonien de Brazza, who had landed on the coast north of the Congo River and headed inland. One day, while he was still building his trail around the rapids, Stanley was startled to have the courtly Frenchman, in a white helmet and blue navy coat, show up at his tent. A still greater shock awaited him at Stanley Pool, where he found that de Brazza had signed a treaty with a chief ceding to France a strip of the northern shoreline. De Brazza had left a sergeant in command of an outpost there, flying the French flag. Stanley was a man who brooked no rivals, and over the next few years he and de Brazza carried on a loud feud. Stanley claimed the French explorer's treaty was based on trickery. His rival called Stanley a warrior who was no friend to the Africans. The Paris press loved it. While Leopold schemed with Stanley about how to outfox de Brazza behind Stanley's back, the king invited the Frenchman to Brussels, gave him the order of Leopold, and tried unsuccessfully to hire him. The comings and goings of Stanley and de Brazza began to arouse interest elsewhere. Doddering Portugal resurrected its old claim to the land surrounding the Congo River's mouth. Britain, worried by French interest in the Congo, backed the Portuguese. Leopold felt he had no time to waste. Stanley, under pressure, drove his men harder. He exploded at white subordinates who were drinking too much or who had let weeds grow around their river stations. "These people had already given me more trouble than all the African tribes put together. They had inspired such disgust in me that I would rather be condemned to be a bootblack all my life than to be a dry nurse to beings who had no claim to manhood." Despite his own brief and inglorious career on opposite sides of the American Civil War, Stanley was at heart a military man. He liked order and discipline, and was a terrifying but effective commander. By now he had amassed a powerful private army equipped with 1,000 quick-firing rifles, 12 small Krupp cannon, and 4 machine guns. Among his Zanzibari soldiers there was a Swahili saying, "Bunduki Sultani ya Barabara," "the gun is the sultan of the hinterland." Meanwhile, Leopold had hired an Oxford scholar, Sir Travers Twiss, to provide a learned legal opinion backing the right of private companies to act as if they were sovereign countries when making treaties with native chiefs. Stanley was under instructions to lead his well-armed forces up and down the river and do just that. The treaties must be as brief as possible, Leopold ordered, and in a couple of articles must grant us everything. They did. By the time Stanley and his officers were done, the blue flag with the gold star fluttered over the villages and territories Stanley claimed of more than 450 Congo Basin chiefs. The texts varied, but many of the treaties gave the king a complete trading monopoly, even as he placated European and American questioners by insisting that he was opening up Africa to free trade. More important, chiefs signed over their land to Leopold, and they did so for almost nothing. At Isangila, near the Big Rapids, Stanley recorded, he was able to buy land for a station by paying some chiefs with an ample supply of fine clothes, flunky coats, and tinsel-braided uniforms, with a rich assortment of divers marketable wares, not omitting a couple of bottles of gin. The conquerors of Africa, like those of the American West, were finding alcohol as effective as the machine gun. The very word treaty is a euphemism, for many chiefs had no idea what they were signing. Few had seen the written word before, and they were being asked to mark their X's to documents in a foreign language and in legalese. The idea of a treaty of friendship between two clans or villages was familiar. The idea of signing over one's land to someone on the other side of the ocean was inconceivable. Did the chiefs of Ngombe and Mafela, for example, have any idea of what they agreed to on April 1, 1884? in return for one piece of cloth per month to each of the undersigned chiefs, besides present of cloth in hand, they promised to freely of their own accord, for themselves and their heirs and successors for ever, give up to the said association the sovereignty and all sovereign and governing rights to all their territories, and to assist by labour or otherwise any works, improvements, or expeditions which the said association shall cause at any time to be carried out in any part of these territories. All roads and waterways running through this country, the right of collecting tolls on the same, and all game, fishing, mining, and forest rights are to be the absolute property of the said association, by labour or otherwise. Stanley's pieces of cloth had bought not just land, but manpower. It was an even worse trade than the Indians made for Manhattan. What kind of societies existed in this land that, unknown to most of its inhabitants, Stanley was busy staking out for the King of the Belgians? There is no simple answer, for what would turn out to be the Congo's borders, if superimposed on the map of Europe, would stretch from Zurich to Moscow to central Turkey. It was as large as the entire United States east of the Mississippi. Although mostly rainforest and savanna, it also embraced volcanic hills and mountains covered with snow and glaciers, some of whose peaks reached higher than the Alps. The peoples of this vast territory were as diverse as the land. They ranged from citizens of large, organizationally sophisticated kingdoms to the pygmies of the Ituri rainforest, who lived in small bands with no chiefs and no formal structure of government. The kingdoms, with large towns as their capitals, tended to be in the savannah, where long-distance travel was easier. In the rainforest, where paths had to be hacked through thick, rapidly growing foliage, communities were generally far smaller. These forest dwellers were sometimes semi-nomads. If a group of pygmies, for instance, killed an elephant, that site became a temporary settlement for a week or two of feasting, since it was easier to move a village than a dead elephant. Although some Congo peoples, like the pygmies, were admirably peaceful, it would be a mistake to see most of them as paragons of primeval innocence. Many practiced slavery and ritual cannibalism, and were as likely to make war on other clans or ethnic groups as people anywhere on earth. And traditional warfare in this part of Africa, where a severed head or hand was sometimes proof of an enemy killed in battle, was as harsh as warfare elsewhere. In some areas of the Congo, all women were maimed, as still happens today, by forced clitoridectomies, a practice no less brutal for being a cultural initiation rite. Like many indigenous peoples, inhabitants of the Congo Basin had learned to live in balance with their environment. Some groups practiced what was, in effect, birth control, where couples had to abstain from sex before the men left on a hunting expedition, for example, or as long as the woman was breastfeeding a baby. Substances found in certain leaves and bark could induce miscarriages or had contraceptive properties. All these means of population control, incidentally, were strikingly similar to those which had evolved in another great rainforest an ocean away, the Amazon basin. Most striking about the traditional societies of the Congo was their remarkable artwork: baskets, mats, pottery, copper and ironwork, and, above all, wood carving. It would be two decades before Europeans really noticed this art. Its discovery then had a strong influence on Braque, Matisse, and Picasso, who subsequently kept African art objects in his studio until his death. Cubism was new only for Europeans, for it was partly inspired by specific pieces of African art, some of them from the Pende and Songhe peoples who live in the basin of the Kasai River, one of the Congo's major tributaries. It is easy to see the distinctive brilliance that so entranced Picasso and his colleagues at their first encounter with this art at an exhibit in Paris in 1907. In these Central African sculptures, some body parts are exaggerated, some shrunken. Eyes project, cheeks sink, mouths disappear, torsos become elongated. Eye sockets expand to cover almost the entire face. The human face and figure are broken apart and formed again in new ways and proportions that had previously lain beyond the sight of traditional European realism. The art sprang from cultures that had, among other things, a looser sense than Islam or Christianity of the boundaries between our world and the next, as well as of those between the world of humans and the world of beasts. Among the Bolia people of the Congo, for example, a king was chosen by a council of elders, by ancestors who appeared to him in a dream, and finally by wild animals, who signalled their assent by roaring during a night when the royal candidate was left at a particular spot in the rainforest. Perhaps it was the fluidity of these boundaries that granted Central Africa's artists a freedom those in Europe had not yet discovered. In June 1884, his work for Leopold done and a sheaf of treaties in his baggage, Stanley sailed home to Europe. He grumbled a bit about his employer's greed. The king, he complained, had the enormous voracity to swallow a million of square miles with a gullet that will not take in a herring. But it was Stanley who made the big swallow possible. As he settled in England to write his usual 1,000-page, 2-volume account of his travels, Stanley found around him a Europe that had awakened to Africa. The scramble had begun. The treaty de Brazza had made at Stanley Pool would soon lead to a French colony on the northwest bank of the Congo River. In Germany, Chancellor Otto von Bismarck wanted colonies in Africa. The British, the outsiders with the most substantial foothold on the continent, were beginning to worry about competitors. Leopold was certain that none of these larger powers would be eager to recognize the one-man colony Stanley had staked out for him. Diplomatic recognition, however, is partly a matter of precedent. Once one major country recognizes another's existence, other nations are likely to fall into line. If no major European country would take this crucial first step, Leopold decided, he would look elsewhere. Unnoticed on his home continent, the king had already quietly begun making a dazzling end run around Europe entirely. Chapter 5. From Florida to Berlin. An unusually late spring snowfall lay thick on the White House lawn as President Chester A. Arthur, wearing a high silk hat, boarded a private car lent to him by the Pennsylvania Railroad and headed south for a vacation. High blood pressure and other complaints had left him tired, he told his staff, and he wanted a good rest in Florida. Traveling with the president as he left Washington on April 5, 1883, were the Secretary of the Navy, Arthur's valet, his personal secretary, and his French chef, whom a journalist on the train described as a gentleman with a well-developed waist, evidently a good feeder. A friend of the president's was also on board, and several of his late wife's cousins joined the party as the train rolled south. After Petersburg, Virginia, as the private car moved onto the tracks of a new railroad, a gray-bearded conductor provoked great hilarity by walking into the car, counting the passengers, and trying to collect $47.50 in fares. A telegram ordering him to let the presidential party travel for free was waiting at the next stop. In Jacksonville, Florida, the president and his entourage were greeted by a 21-gun salute. They then boarded a paddle-wheel steamer and headed up the winding St. John's River, lined with cypress trees and flocks of herons and cranes. More friends and relatives joined the sociable president along the way, and fireworks shot up from the banks of the river. The following day, the steamer tied up at a spot some 35 miles from today's Disney World, where the party climbed into carriages to visit the elegant mansion of the Bel Air Orange Plantation. They tasted different varieties of the plantation's prize oranges, and the Secretary of the Navy climbed a tree to pick some that particularly caught his eye. In the evening, the presidential entourage watched a song and dance performance, with banjo music, by a troupe of 6 local black boys. One of the more forgettable of American presidents, Chester A. Arthur, was an amiable man whose highest job, only a few years earlier, had been as collector of customs revenue for the Port of New York, a position he had been forced to leave amid charges of corruption and mismanagement. Soon after this, Arthur's ties to the powerful New York State Republican machine won him nomination as candidate for vice president. To near universal dismay, he had entered the White House when President James A. Garfield died from an assassin's bullet. A good storyteller and man about town, fond of whiskey, cigars, and expensive clothes, the dapper, sideburned Arthur is perhaps best remembered for saying, "I may be President of the United States, but my private life is nobody's damned business." On this trip to Florida, however, his private life fitted very nicely into someone else's business. The owner of the Bel Air Orange Plantation was General Henry Shelton Sanford, the man who had helped Leopold recruit Stanley. Sanford did not bother to leave his home in Belgium to be in Florida for the president's visit. With the self-assurance of the very rich, he played host in absentia. He made sure that the president and his party were greeted by his personal agent, and that they got the best rooms at the Sanford House Hotel, which stood on a lakeshore fringed with palm trees in the town of Sanford. When the president and his guests were not out catching bass, trout and catfish, or shooting alligators, or exploring the area by steamboat, the Sanford House was where they stayed for the better part of a week. There is no record of who paid the hotel bill, but most likely, as with the rail journey south, it was not the president. Ironically, the huge Sanford orange plantation the Washington visitors admired was proving as disastrous a venture as Sanford's other investments. Some Swedish contract laborers found the working conditions too harsh and tried to leave as stowaways on a steamboat. A slaughterhouse Sanford invested in had a capacity 50 times larger than what the local market could consume and went bankrupt. A 540-foot wharf with a warehouse at the end of it that he ordered built was washed away by a flood. The manager of one of the hotels in Sanford absconded while owing him money. Foremen failed to put up fences, and wandering cattle nibbled at the orange trees. But if everything Sanford touched as a businessman turned to dust, as an accomplice of Leopold, he was a grand success. Sanford was a long-time supporter of President Arthur's Republican Party. For 2 years, he had been corresponding with Arthur and other high United States officials about Leopold's plans for the Congo. Now, after the president's trip to Florida, confident that Arthur would pay attention, he pressed his case with more letters. 7 months later, Leopold sent Sanford across the Atlantic to make use of his convenient connection to the White House. The man who had once been American minister to Belgium was now the Belgium King's personal envoy to Washington. Sanford carried with him to Washington a special code for telegraphing news to Brussels. Constance meant negotiations proceeding satisfactorily, success expected. Achille referred to Stanley, Eugénie to France, Alice to the United States, Joseph to sovereign rights, and Émile to the key target, the president. Bonheur, happiness, meant agreement signed today. The agreement Leopold wanted was one that gave full American diplomatic recognition of his claim to the Congo. Sanford also carried a letter to the president from the king, which he himself had carefully edited and translated. "Entire territories ceded by sovereign chiefs have been constituted by us into independent states," Leopold declared, a claim that would have startled Stanley, then finishing up his work on the Congo River. From Arthur, Leopold asked only, "The official announcement that the government of the United States will treat as a friendly flag the blue standard with the golden star which now floats over 17 stations, many territories, 7 steamers engaged in the civilizing work of the association, and over a population of several millions." On November 29, 1883, only 2 days after his ship arrived in New York and he had boarded the overnight train for Washington, Sanford was received by President Arthur at the White House. Leopold's great work of civilization, he told the president and everyone else he met in Washington, was much like the generous work the United States itself had done in Liberia, where, starting in 1820, freed American slaves had moved to what soon became an independent African country. This was a shrewdly chosen example, since it had not been the United States government that had resettled ex-slaves in Liberia, but a private society like Leopold's International Association of the Congo. Like all the actors in Leopold's highly professional cast, Sanford relied on just the right props. He claimed, for example, that Leopold's treaties with Congo chiefs were similar to those which the Puritan clergyman, Roger Williams, famed for his belief in Indian rights, had made in Rhode Island in the 1600s. And Sanford just happened to have copies of those treaties with him. Furthermore, in his letter to President Arthur, Leopold promised that American citizens would be free to buy land in the Congo, and that American goods would be free of customs duties there. In support of these promises, Sanford had with him a sample copy of one of Leopold's treaties with a Congo chief. The copy, however, had been altered in Brussels to omit all mention of the monopoly on trade ceded to Leopold, an alteration that deceived not only Arthur, but also Sanford, an ardent free trader who wanted the Congo open to American businessmen like himself. In Washington, Sanford claimed that Leopold's civilizing influence would counter the practices of the dreadful Arab slave traders, And weren't these independent states, under the association's generous protection, really a sort of United States of the Congo? Not to mention that, as Sanford wrote to Secretary of State Frederick Frelinghuysen, Stanley was still vigorously passing himself off as born and bred in the United States, the Congo was discovered by an American? Only a week after Sanford arrived in Washington, the President cheerfully incorporated into his annual message to Congress, only slightly rewritten, text that Sanford had drafted for him about Leopold's high-minded work in the Congo. The rich and populous valley of the Congo is being opened by a society called the International African Association, of which the King of the Belgians is the president. Large tracts of territory have been seized.